For the last month, we've been going through a set of topics that in the early Buddhist system, the Buddha would often teach before he taught the big liberation topics of like the Four Noble Truths and deep letting go and, you know, the nature of the self and all that. These are in some ways the kind of bedrock foundations of practice. And the list starts with giving or dana. That giving of one's resources, generosity, and the act of supporting others, being generous to others, as the basis of the path, as the beginning of letting go, the cultivation of community, the beginning of, in a sense, all other wise action, the action to care for each other in relationship and community, begins with giving. And then ethics itself, sila, the ethical precepts that we chant at the beginning of each class, the practice of turning away from habitual actions that harm others, that take that which isn't offered, that misuse sexuality and speech and intoxicants. In a way, all of the ethical precepts are based in, we might, if we want to think about everything in the framework of pleasures, they're based somehow in grasping at pleasures in a way that is addictive or compulsive, such that it causes us to forget ourselves in relationship. I want something, and I want to take it, or lie to get it, or in all these various ways, the precepts can be thought of as like, well, why would you do those things? Why would you hurt somebody, or take that which isn't offered to you, or act in a harmful way, and using sexuality, or lie, or become intoxicated in a way that causes you to act heedlessly. In all of those ways, we might say you forgot relationship, you forgot community, you forgot the effects of your actions, and you were grasping at something, some kind of pleasure, or security, or safety in some way. So the list starts with giving and ethics. I inserted an extra talk on community in there, which I think of as a deep foundation. And then last week, I talked about something that my teachers have never talked with me about, so this was purely from reading and studying more in Asian traditions, which is heavens. We talked about how wholesome action can lead to heaven realms, or what the heaven realms might be in Buddhism, how they're not permanent, but how we might understand them, especially those of us that come from any of the Western monotheisms that have a concept about eternal heaven. So we talked about heaven last week, which was fun. So now we've got two more topics in this first list, and they're interlinked. The first is the dangers of sense pleasures, and then the second is renunciation. Again, almost none of my Western Buddhist teachers talk on the dangers of sense pleasure, because, you know, the hall empties out pretty quickly. No one really wants to hear it. We are a fairly hedonistic crew in the progressive, comfortable classes that have taken up insight meditation, certainly, and many forms of convert Buddhism. But the dangers of sense pleasures is a topic that the Buddha taught on over and over, and in a certain way it's the basis of the whole liberation path. It goes something like this. The quality of pleasure that is possible through any of the senses, pleasurable smells, pleasurable tastes, pleasurable physical contact with anything, pleasurable thoughts as well, pleasurable ideas, pleasurable contact. Pleasure is so profoundly attractive as an experience that in a way it is the thing that we're clinging to. Right? We feel like we're clinging to specific things. You know, I really covet having quality tea to drink, or I really want to make love with this person, or I really want to have the feeling of owning my home, or I really want to look at this really beautiful piece of art, or I really want to, et cetera, et cetera, have my neighborhood be like the way I want it to be, like comfortable, pleasurable. I like to be warm. Like all of these things that are on kind of a spectrum from, you know, basic survival needs, where there's, the sense pleasure of being warm and safe, for instance, through the pleasures in relationship, for instance, and through even to the aesthetic pleasures of art and beauty. All of these things, if our whole sensory experience is divided essentially into pleasurable stuff that happens in all those categories and then unpleasant stuff that happens in all those categories, it's natural, so deeply natural, to want the pleasurable and to not want the painful, that this is really what we're doing all the time, is we're going for, you know, we're going for comfort. What can I have that's comfortable? How can I make this better? You know. Over there by the Buddha statue, there's three candles. They're beautiful. They're nice candles. I really could have no complaints. Beautiful Buddha statue, nice little temple space, candles. Except that the two candles on the right are the same height, and the one on the left is lower. And I would switch them so that the one that was lower was in the middle, so they were more symmetrical, and that would ping my pleasure visuals a tiny bit more. And like of all the sort of, like, really? Things are so lovely, and I'm just like, yeah, but if I just, that would be just even better. And like a little burr in my sock would be gone, you know? And how I live my life in that way. Like, I really, really, really just wish there wasn't that tangled piece of white thread on the red carpet. So much so that I'm just going to kind of swoop down and pick it up on the way through. And it's going to be better. And it would be so much better if, you know, my complaining child complained in a quieter voice. Or, and the list goes on, you know, infinitely on. The proposal is, this is natural, it's habitual, but it's painful. It's painful because you'll never get it. You'll never win. You'll never be able to perfectly adjust your circumstances to be reliably pleasurable. Someone always moves the candle, or talks in a loud voice, or evicts you, or harms you. Like, it is, you know, and then death. And so we're in this predicament where we're immersed in a world where there's pleasure and pain. It's natural to want pleasure and to fear or dislike pain, but it's impossible to achieve only pleasure and not pain. And so then the Buddha says, that being the case, the urge to try must be the problem. The thing that makes you suffer or ache in relation to existing is not the fact that painful things happen and pleasurable things happen. It's that you can't rest in your heart in relation to them. And this is a not really intuitive conclusion, but he comes to it, as the sages throughout the classical yoga traditions did, by practicing in a way that really focused attention on pleasure and pain. He said, I really, really investigated pleasure and pain and found no solution to the problem of heartache and angst and despair other than to radically change my relationship to these two things. Because nothing succeeded in attaining satisfaction other than that. And he particularly tried two ways. One way was to become really skilled at pleasure. Right? He tried the first way first. He grew up wealthy, and I think that his conclusion that you have to let go of addiction to pleasure, by the way, is not disconnected from the fact that he grows up wealthy. He knows what it means to have every pleasure that resources could buy. He grew up that way, and he was like, this is not satisfying. And what he really says about it is like, I have all these pleasures, but I'm still going to die and get sick and get old and lose them. That's not satisfying at all, no matter how good they are in the moment. I'm haunted by the reality of their impending loss. Right? He said, oh, you can't hold on to those. Then he goes for meditative pleasure. He gets really good at the states of calm and serenity so that he can rest in blissful emptiness. Long stretches of you know, pure mind states that are thought of as the most pleasurable things in existence. You know, if you could take that peak moment of like energy but also selfless, blown open emptiness that you might find at, say, the infinitesimally short peak or like plateau even of, say, orgasm or a deep, deep altered state, those end. Sometimes they end very quickly, sometimes they sustain a little while. In meditation, you can touch that kind of blissful absorption, but it only lasts as long as the meditation. And, you know, at best, that's a few days. If you're like a powerhouse meditator, for most of us, it's a few minutes at most. So he says, okay, sense pleasures coming through wealth, they don't last. Sense pleasures of meditation last a little bit longer, but only while you're in them. And you come out of meditation and you're still subject to birth, to old age, sickness, and death. And rebirth into old age, sickness, and death. He says, that's not sad. That doesn't do it either. Then he says, okay, so let's attack this problem from the other angle. And he says, instead of trying to conquer pleasures, I'm going to try to conquer pain by having the most pain possible. And he goes through this period in his practice where he torments the body, where he starves himself and you know, sits still for weeks on end and puts himself in painful positions and almost dies, basically, of starvation. And then he does practices within that. He tries to hold his breath, like, without letting it go, you know, until he says, like, it was like somebody carved up my head with a butcher's knife. It was so painful. And he tries multiple ways. And this is, as a side note, this is one of the earliest records we have of breath-holding pranayama in the Indian tradition, 500 years BCE, so almost 2,000 years before the Hatha Yoga texts talk about breath holding in pranayama, we get a Buddhist text talking about breath holding. But he concludes actually in those texts that it doesn't work for him. And what he does throughout the ascetic practices is he tries to conquer pain by being like, okay, I'll tolerate pain. Let's do this. Let's get to the end of this pain thing. But that doesn't do it either. And so when he discovers the middle way, he realizes, like, okay, it's not about stabilizing pleasure or like conquering pain somehow, but that right in the middle, there's a path, the middle path, where the body is nourished and able to rest in pleasure, but also isn't trying to sustain or grasp that pleasure. Where the body uses or the mind uses embodied pleasure as a doorway to investigate. And it's that investigation that leads to liberation. And that investigation essentially is into what might be possible if I understand the fleeting nature of pleasure, the inevitable nature of pain, the constantly fluctuating nature of everything. Everything ends. That's the big insight. Nothing lasts. No pleasure lasts. No pain lasts. No sense of myself in any way lasts. He figures this out, and that ends it. And from there, the teaching then is rooted in these early steps that we're now talking about in a teaching on the dangers of sense pleasures. And the danger is really basically that they're addictive, that they confuse the mind. It's not that they're wrong or bad, simply that when they are the focus, we act in ways that cause harm. And acting in ways that cause harm makes liberation harder, further away. And so there's a teaching that gets repeated throughout the texts, a little set of phrases called the gratification, the danger, and the escape. So the gratification, in the case of sense pleasures, essentially is that they feel good. And again, that doesn't mean they're bad, right? Or that you should, like, not have any sense pleasures. The gratification is the truth of their feeling good. They feel good. The danger is that you get attached. Or that you don't see how attached you are. And that based in being attached really comes down to actions. Based in being attached, you act in ways that are unskillful. So, you know, if we take the greatest sense pleasure of them all, at least classically speaking, sex. Nothing in the text says that sex is bad or wrong. Sex is awesome. I promised on Facebook that in giving a talk on the dangers of sense pleasures, I would say that sex is awesome. Sex is awesome. There's nothing wrong with it. That was a Christian thing, right? Nothing to do with sin here. There's the gratification. It's awesome. The danger is that it's so awesome that you might behave in a harmful way because of it. So, like, you might have sex with the wrong person or in a way that causes harm in various ways. And we know how profound in our culture and in so many cultures sexual harm is. To the point where you know, harm caused through sexuality is not even really about sexuality anymore, but you know, things like abuse and rape are crimes of hatred and misogyny in many ways. You know. Not even crimes of sexuality based in desire, but that there is this way that the desire for sexual contact or sensual interpersonal contact is so strong that it distorts our thinking and our seeing in the world in so many ways. And so the danger is that sense pleasures confuse us, really. Right? We fall into a distorted mind state where it's all I want, and I contract around it. The escape, of course, is letting go. Right? The escape is somehow escaping the addiction. And escaping doesn't necessarily mean abstaining. Right? It's not like suddenly you're not going to have any sense pleasures. After the Buddha's enlightenment, people ask him what he does all day. He mostly meditates. But he says, you know, most of the time, I just rest in the bliss of emptiness. Like, he's not clinging onto anything. He doesn't crave any sense pleasures. He doesn't fear death. And, you know, he's got a pretty simple life that he set up. As a monk, he goes to beg for food once a day. The rest of the day is open. He teaches a little bit, whatever, walks somewhere. Mostly he sits in meditation. And that sitting in meditation is very pleasurable. Because when the mind is not worried, not spinning on things, not grasping at things, not trying to figure out the future, there's not much else to do. And one of the secrets of the mind, of our neurology in a way, it seems to be true, is that when you're not worried, it feels pretty good. Like, the baseline is pretty blissful if you're not having a bad time. So if you can figure out how to be content with little in the material realm, right, how to live a simple, non-materially intensive life and not have to work too much, which is what the whole monastic system was about, the mind can get pretty quiet. And as the mind gets pretty quiet, it gets pretty pleasurable. So the Buddha really digs pleasure, actually, right? He's just not addicted to it. And he's not afraid of its end. One of the things that's kind of secret sauce in this teaching is that if you don't have access to meditative pleasure, this becomes a much more difficult task. Because in a certain way, you're being asked to turn away from grasping at conditioned pleasures like food pleasures and relational pleasures and, you know, pure sensory pleasures, you're asked to turn away from those or not be so attached to those, but you don't have much to replace it with, right? If like, okay, so I've got kind of a simple life, but I'm sort of just like unhappy. That's not a really good, that's not very convincing. And if you're unhappy, you almost certainly are going to turn back toward the sensual pleasures. How could you not? Right? You're going to have a drink, or you're going to watch some Walking Dead, or like whatever you do that you like. Because I really just think, like, as the kind of animal we are, we have to experience pleasures, or else we go insane, basically. You have to actually let, because pleasure is partly how the mind relaxes, realizes that it's safe, not under threat, gets to soften. So next week we'll talk about the beauty of renunciation, of deep letting go, which is the pathway toward letting go of the addiction to sense pleasures, and the fear of pain. But as the practice would continue, it continues right into the instructions for how to meditate, how to rest the mind. And this is, in a way, I think almost more important than we realize. That in order to turn away from our addiction to certain experiences, especially resource-intensive experiences, I think we have to replace them with something. And that something needs to be wholesome and ethical and not cause harm. Which is partly why the meditative pleasures are so good, because they use no resources. Right? So the other thing I promised to say something about was billionaires. And how hashtag AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, every time I say her name, my wife Sarah goes, she is 29. And I'm like, I know, that is so good. How her new tax plan, you know, that like brings in a new marginal tax bracket of like 75% once you make more than $10 million a year. And she said a really good thing. She's talking about it, as she does all the time now, last few weeks. And she said, really, this is just a tax version of essentially a moral principle that we think that there don't need to be billionaires in the world as it is right now. That like, that's just not appropriate given how much poverty there is, that resources need to be spent differently. And so if we think of addiction to sense pleasures, mostly in the Buddhist literature and teaching, the emphasis is almost always on the individual. Like, how do I not be so, you know, constricted around like sensuality or you know, food or you know, things. But what if we zoom out a bit and say, what if addiction to sense pleasures is actually the cause of, let's say, climate change and colonialism and the profound pain that our global cultures are in right now? You know, when I first learned that, like, the fuel for much of the first waves of colonization of South Asia and Southeast Asia was spices, right? And I'm like, you conquered all of Madagascar because you wanted the smell of nutmeg and cinnamon? Like, that's it? That was it? And you think about the big one, really. Like, think about, you know, the Middle Passage and the Atlantic slave trade. And that so much of it was about sugar, sugar cane. And I'm like, a bunch of folks in Northern Europe who didn't have a naturally occurring sweetener other than honey discovered sugar cane and destroyed the whole world to get more of it. That's a taste. Like, that's a sense pleasure. Like, wow, addiction to sense pleasures, you know. to the spices, to sugar, and then to the sense pleasure of not having to work so hard for raw materials. Like, oh, let's have you know, the Indian subcontinent, like, grow and weave the cotton. Because we like the comfortable feel of cotton on our skin rather than, you know, fuzzy Norwegian wool or whatever, like British, you know, like scratchy fabric. Like, oh, let's go for Indian cotton. Like you can start to, and then not to even mention the, you know, tobacco and opium. And we think about, like, why did Europe so badly need to colonize the rest of the world? And extract resources, and you can bring so much of it down to the sense pleasures that wealth would provide. Both these specific objects, you know, all the stimulants, basically, right? Tea, coffee, chocolate, sugar. It's like, let's get more of these. And then just wealth itself, like, oh, all the trade that's going to happen, that's going to draw or extract wealth and concentrate it in these few cultures. The whole structure of extractive capitalism can be thought of as a kind of metastasized version of the lust for sensual pleasures. And if that's the case, then renunciation, not just individual, like, oh, I'm gonna work to have less sugar in my diet or less Netflix in my diet or less, you know, whatever. Maybe, especially at this point, a little beside the point. It's not necessarily just that, but that we can really think about the whole structure of our culture as a structure that was built by a few people to maximize their access to sensory pleasure and the illusion of safety and luxury, and damn the consequences. Like, it doesn't even matter how many people are suffering so that a few people can get these sensory experiences, the sensory experience of, you know, getting your way, basically. And if we think about power, like, yes, power as the motivator in so many ways, what's so great about power? We could think about, like, what happens when you're powerful. One of the things you can do is you can, you know, we could think about the urge for power as still being caught in that first thing the Buddha tried to figure out, which was, can you get enough resources and enough power and enough force on your side that you can maintain a constant access to comfort? Right? And even that, like, the ideas that you favor have comfort, meaning they spread, you know, like, oh, my ideas are the dominant ideas. My people are the ones that are comfortable, right? Oh, it's not just me that's comfortable, but, like, all the people in my family are safe. All the people of my ethnicity are comfortable. But this is going to lead to, like, just the concentration of wealth in the same way that if I covet a certain thing, I just have this need to gather it toward me. And so the danger in sense pleasure becomes a practice where, because we're not monastics, but also because we're immersed in the culture that we're in, and many of us, I think, hold a kind of humanistic or I want to, in a certain way, also say, like body positive, sensuality positive worldview, our task in a certain way is to cultivate action and cultivate community that doesn't, that resists the demonization of pleasure, that's been part of certainly Western Judeo-Christian societies. And at the same time, resists the tendency toward addiction, contraction, grasping. So that we are both, pleasure positive and liberation positive. And I think that's a balance that Western Buddhism has not yet worked out, how to be both of those things. I think mostly we skate over both of them. Your thoughts and feelings about pleasures, that where this makes sense or doesn't make sense, difficult bits. How do you relate to pleasure in your life? Question that you might ask yourself, a way to feel into this, might be something like, what is my relationship to comfort? Do I think about it? Do I not? Like, can I feel myself craving it? Or am I comfortable enough that it's kind of a non-issue, like I don't really have to think about it that much? Do I feel like comfort or well-being is scarce in some way, that I have to struggle to maintain it? Do I get to take it for granted? How do I work with wanting certain experiences that are comfortable or pleasurable or even blissful or ecstatic?
I'm thinking of, because I have been more conscientious the last few years about the things I take in and my pleasures. And I think one big thing I notice is a sense of defensiveness at times that I have when I, like, you know, the kind of, oh, I need my coffee in the morning. Like, you know, that kind of thing. And the sense of, like, justifying it. Like, oh, but I'm doing all these good things in the world and the coffee helps me do that.
Yeah.
So therefore, it's okay, and you know.
Yeah.
So there's that piece, and then also the. And this isn't necessarily something I do regularly, but I notice, like, with other people, like, is sometimes with this, and this is where I think what you're saying about it not being an individual thing and becoming a more of a global stance, the kind of, like, patting yourself on the back for giving up pleasures, or, you know,
mm-hmm.
and the kind of, like, hierarchy that can develop in terms
sure.
of, like, oh, well, I've given up all these things and I'm helping the world in these ways, like, what are you doing? Kind of, you know, and
yeah.
which I know, like, some people say is their complaint about, like, vegans, for example, but, you know, and, like, other vegans, for don't do it, but some will be kind of
militant. Righteous.
Yeah. So I think when it becomes less of a, I'm just curious about, like, how you see it becoming more of a global or cultural, social thing in ways that
mm-hmm.
that fighting doesn't happen. And
yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Partly because, you know, like in the examples that you're giving, which are so on point, It's really a task to disentangle the mainstream cultural messages, where, you know, a kind of, you know, justifying of my coffee or a patting myself on the back for letting go of something, like, it's really hard for me to do anything. Let's see, it's really hard for me to analyze those things without having to really take Christianity into account, and like sin and a kind of martyrdom and how America was founded by Puritans who were really into self-denial, you know, and all of these aspects in culture here that that are in many ways, you know, where we have a legacy of body hatred and of fear of pleasure, and, you know, that weaves into all sorts of things like misogyny, you know. Like some of the ancient texts on why, you know, on like why women should never be in power is that they feel pleasure more strongly than men, right? The story from the Greek kind of mythic narratives about the sage Tiresias, the blind sage, who through a various sort of curse of the gods slash gift slash complex relationship with the gods, at one point was originally a man, changed into being in the body of a woman for 7 years, and then went back to being in the body of a man. And when he went back into the being of a body, to being in a male body, he was asked whose pleasure in sex was greater, man's or woman's. And he said, a woman's pleasure is greater by 7 times. And for that, for saying that, he was made blind by the gods. So this has all sorts of layers in it that would be, you know, but some sense that, like, it all hinged on pleasure. It all hinged on sexual pleasure. That gender difference hinged on sexual pleasure. And then in a certain way, the kind of the maintenance of the patriarchy had something to do with how much pleasure women could experience. And so those threads go way back, you know, and the way that Christianity became, especially through some of its lineages, you know, some of the Protestant lineages particularly, but you know, in my Catholic lineage as well, you know, really sort of body denying, pleasure denying, which turns into nature denying, which supports resource extraction, etc. All of that coming together. That's really hard to undo. And so then, in practice, what you might do, you know, might be something like, if you notice, you know, the kind of like the coffee justification or the pride at renouncing something or a kind of righteousness come in, you could, any of those messages, you could feel into them. You might be like, oh, look, there's that story, you know, that I'm good for having given this up or that I'm bad for continuing to do this or whatever. You might feel it. And what you could do is like say the story to yourself and then feel the emotional or kind of, you know, the tone in you. It's going to be pleasant or unpleasant. You know, like, oh, I feel better because I don't eat meat. Whatever, I know that feeling, right? And I would want to feel into it and be like, what's happening here? And to notice that there's maybe like layers of identity that are contracting around it. There's certainly layers of like building up the self, like building up the idea that I could be right. And therefore, in a certain way, we could say, oh, even the thought I'm doing it right is a kind of sensory pleasure. Because it's more pleasurable to think that I'm doing it right than to feel a kind of a, oh no, maybe I'm not doing it right. Maybe somebody else is doing it better, you know. Shame is painful, right, etc. So, and then I might investigate, like, sometimes I'll ask the question when I hear a certain narrative that seems like it might be harmful. I might ask, like, whose voice is this? You know, is this my, like, father or mother? Say, is that my mom's voice, you know, where she'd be like, don't do that, that's not the right thing to do. And I find myself saying it, and I'm like, oh, hey, mom, you know, mom who's been dead for 15 years, is like talking to me, being like, don't do that, you know, You know, so I'm like, oh, that's not me in a certain way. Like, oh, that's a family karma that comes through her or him. Or I might be like, oh, that's the church. That's a message that I got from this place. Or like, oh, that's a message from this part of the culture or that part of the culture. That's partly how I might even want to discern that, like, the idea that you might be bad in any way for, you know, relying on coffee to get you through late-stage neoliberal apocalyptic capitalism, you know, which I'm like, helps me out. Seriously. Like, but the idea that you might be bad for that, I could feel into that, and I would feel a kind of ascetic Christianity in that, is one of the places that, at least in my system, it goes. Who taught you that? Right? You could be part of a culture that is like, you know, the gods gave us the bean of profound energy. Like, praise the bean. Right? Because certainly all the stimulants were sacred at some point. Right? Tobacco is sacred. Coffee is sacred. Chocolate is sacred. You know? Cannabis is sacred. You know, opium is sacred. It can be misused. You know, for sure. Right? So, in all these ways, the problem, as always, is not the substance. It's not the thing. You know, alcohol is not a problem. Addiction is a problem. You know, and in the texts, when it says, like, this is why you shouldn't drink, it doesn't say because drinking is bad. It says because when you drink, you hurt people and you say harmful things and you have sex with the wrong people and you basically misbehave in ways that are destructive to the community and the relationships. It always comes down to action. So the danger of sense pleasures is that they delude you. They make you see not clearly. Mm-hmm. You know. So if you think of all the sense pleasures as stimulants in a certain way, you know, then like, oh, what I want is not to perpetuate the myth that if I just keep getting new stimulants every minute, I'll have as little pain as possible and hopefully die painlessly. Mm-hmm. Right? That, like, that was an illusion, you know? But that, oh, if I see what I actually want, and this is the thing that destroys addiction, what I actually want is not the comfort. What I actually want is clarity. Mm-hmm. And liberation. And liberation, the liberated mind, is so much more pleasurable than a sensory pleasure. That if you can learn how to touch into it, it pretty much demolishes the other. This is why the pathway of meditation goes through pleasure, embodied pleasure. You can learn to rest in full body, like stabilized, pleasurable radiance. And you totally can learn this, right? Without any sensory stimulus. You don't need to conquer anybody. You don't need to buy anything. You don't need to engage in any kind of harm whatsoever in the world. And that skill is part of what begins to destroy the addiction to sensory pleasures. Because you just don't... You see through them, really, and then don't need them anymore. So, yeah. It's a good question, really, about how we... in a certain way, like, deal with harmful messages in the mind, in a way, you know, all the justifications that wrap around the sensory experience. So, cool. So next week we'll continue right in the same way from here. The final topic in this series is the benefits of renunciation. And it's really just the thing that flows naturally from this spot. It's like, okay, well, based in this, let's talk about letting go and what it means to just turn away from things that that were never really serving you anyway. So we'll go there. Thanks for being here. It's a pleasure to sit together. Happy New Year's. Happy Yin Earth Pig.
Such a funny image.
It is indeed. It's the Yin Earth Pig.
It's like in a restorative pose.
Totally, totally. It's little pink limbs draped over. The sweetest image that I saw of it was a Tibetan Losar image that had rolling, lush, green hills, and at the center of it, this shining sort of pastel pink, like mama pig, like shining with light and rainbows all around the circle. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like earthy, warm, pleasurable, piggish. Earth pig. It's going to be good. So, you know. All right, blessings on our country and everyone in the whole world. So, see you again soon.